Hello, I'm your reader, Susan Hack, and it's time for our birthdays. We're excited to celebrate with several of our listeners today. Angela M. Hutton of Waukee, happy birthday. Bobby Edwards from Des Moines, happy birthday to you too. Arthur H. Bay of Council Bluffs, happy birthday. Rena Stackhouse of Indianola, have a great birthday. Artis Coase of Denison, happy birthday. Robert Norris of Clive, happy birthday to you. And a wonderful birthday wishes to Harlan Nielsen of Dyke. If today is your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Let's get back to the news with our first story from the front page of the USA Today. Quote, nightmare scenario. End quote. COVID-19 surge is dire and getting worse. In U.S., a death every 107 seconds as third wave hits. By John Bacon. The U.S. set a record this week for new coronavirus cases over a seven-day period, with more than 500,000 infections. An American is testing positive every 1.2 seconds. Daily deaths are also climbing. One of us is dying every 107 seconds, according to Johns Hopkins data. And daily hospitalizations have been rising steadily for more than a month, from 28,608 on September 20th to more than 44,000 on Tuesday. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers, whose state is experiencing one of the nation's worst outbreaks, said, "There's no way to sugarcoat it. We are facing an urgent crisis, and there is an imminent risk to you, your family members, your friends, your neighbors, and the people you care about." As winter approaches, America is facing a crucial fork in the road, said Melissa Nolan, an infectious disease expert and professor at the University of South Carolina. "We might see a larger surge due to the pandemic fatigue Americans are experiencing," Nolan told USA Today. "Americans are tired of adhering to public health guidelines and getting tested," she said. She repeated the familiar plea of public health experts: masks, social distancing, hand washing, risk mitigation strategies until a vaccine is developed. While the White House's science policy office ranked, quote, "ending the COVID-19 pandemic," end quote, among President Donald Trump's top achievements, the world isn't buying in. Stock markets around the globe fell sharply Wednesday amid investor fears that global lockdowns are once again on the horizon. "We're well behind this virus," Dr. Mike Ryan, executive director of the World Health Organization's Emergencies Program, said this week. "We will have to get ahead of this virus, and that may require sacrifice for many, many people in terms of their personal lives." Some suggest a national lockdown might allow a, quote, "reset" for states more severely affected to reduce their spiraling numbers. But that is unlikely to happen given the political climate, most experts agree. A national mandate from the federal government for universal masking is more likely to achieve the greatest impact to reduce deaths in the next several months, said Robert Glatter, an emergency physician at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City. That's not very likely either, however. Meanwhile, states like Wisconsin suffer. State officials there are urging residents to stay home and avoid social gatherings, despite a series of legal challenges that have frustrated efforts by Evers to order restrictions. "It's a nightmare scenario, frankly, that this could get quite a bit worse in the next several weeks or months before it gets better," said Ryan Westergaard, chief medical officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Experts say at least one vaccine candidate could win FDA approval by year's end. But that could just be the beginning of questions related to vaccinating a nation of more than 300 million people and a world of more than 7 billion people. Nolan warns that until it becomes apparent what type of vaccine clears FDA guidelines for mass distribution, What problems the nation faces in getting it to the public won't be fully known. For example, some vaccines require refrigeration. And because this is how the world works in 2020, it turns out we are nearing a national shortage of clinical laboratory refrigerators. We still don't know how well any vaccines actually will work. And even if they do work, Americans must be convinced it is safe and effective before they line up to get the shot. Once a vaccine is available, quote, uptake issues, end quote, must be overcome, said Ogbonnaya Omenka, an associate professor and public health specialist at Butler University. Will the vaccine be mandatory or optional? And if mandatory, how will it be enforced? Quote, in view of the clash between individual liberty and public health, end quote. Also, there are questions of prioritization, figuring out who should get the vaccine first, because there won't be enough to go around for some time. Young, healthy people would seem to be last in line, but what effect will that have on in-classroom learning for students? There is also evidence that vaccine hesitancy may be higher in minority communities, the communities that have been hit the hardest by the pandemic, said Dr. Anuj Mehta, a pulmonary and critical care physician at National Jewish Health in Denver. Convincing people that a vaccine is safe and effective will be a critical part of widespread dissemination, he said. Trump, who recovered from COVID-19 this month, continues to downplay the latest wave of infections. We're rounding the turn, the president said at a recent campaign stop. We're doing great. Our numbers are incredible, he said. Trump points to daily death totals, which, while rising, have not reached numbers seen in April, when thousands of Americans died each day. Glatter said deaths have not reached those numbers during this surge because of increased testing, more judicious use of intubation, and non-invasive forms of ventilation, and use of steroids and the medication remdesivir when indicated. The world is also struggling. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said Wednesday that he has gone into quarantine. India is second only to the U.S. in reported infections, nearing the 8 million mark. In Europe, several nations are weighing tougher restrictions. European Union officials on Wednesday urged the bloc's 27 nations to introduce common rules to test for the disease and track its spread, to help prevent further damage to their virus-battered economies. We are seeing a large number of cases. We are seeing widespread disease in Europe, Ryan said. We are seeing very, very high positivity rates and an increasing lack of capacity to do any effective form of contact tracing, he said. When will it all end? There are so many variables, it's not easy to say. Glatter said it will take 3 years. Nolan went out on a limb. Next spring, she said. Next, from the front page, a USA Today exclusive poll. Most in U.S. fear election violence. Only 1 in 4 expect peaceful transition if president loses. By Susan Page and Sarah Elbeshbizzi. Americans are increasingly worried about what will happen at the finish line of this year's tumultuous election, a new USA Today Suffolk University poll finds, including whether the voting will be peaceful and the outcome broadly accepted. 3 of 4 voters express concern about the possibility of violence on election day. Only 1 in 4 say they are, quote, very confident, end quote, that the nation will have a peaceful transfer of power if Democratic challenger Joe Biden defeats President Donald Trump. There's a very angry undertone out there right now, said Monica Ponton, 72, of St. Petersburg, Florida. The registered nurse, a Democrat who was called in the survey, has already cast her ballot for Biden. I'm in my 70s, and I feel like this is one of the scariest times I've ever seen for America since possibly President Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, she said. Biden holds a steady 8-point lead over Trump in the nationwide poll, 52-44%, taken after the final presidential debate last Thursday. That reflects little change since the survey taken at Labor Day, the launch of the fall campaign season, when the former vice president led by 7 points, 50-43%. The stability in the horse race isn't reflected in confidence about the vote itself, though, including fears that aren't traditionally associated with mature democracies. The findings underscore the challenges the eventual winner will face if he wants to unite and reassure an anxious nation. "I think it's a bit rocky right now," Rachel Haig, a stay-at-home mother of three from Boise, Idaho, replied when asked in a follow-up interview about how things were going in the country. A Republican, she plans to go to the polls on Election Day to vote for Trump. "Just about everyone has been touched by COVID-19. A majority of those surveyed, 53%, say the pandemic has had a, quote, major impact, end quote, on their lives. An additional 30% say it has had a minor impact. That impact includes the disease itself, which has infected nearly 9 million Americans and killed more than 227,000. And the economic upheaval in its wake. I asked an open-ended question to name the single issue that was the most important in deciding their vote. 19% cited the economy and jobs. 10% said the pandemic, and an additional 9% said healthcare, a related concern. The only other issue that reached double digits was, quote, character, honesty, trust, end quote, mentioned by 10%. There was a partisan divide on what issue mattered most. Republicans were much more likely to cite the economy, not the coronavirus, as their driving concern, 32% compared with 4%. But Democrats were much more likely to cite the pandemic, not the economy, 15% compared with 5%. Together, those two concerns overwhelmed others, even hot-button issues. Just 3% named abortion rights or the environment and climate change. 2% mentioned taxes or immigration, and 1% mentioned gun control or education. "The lockdowns are hard on people," said Amy Callahan, 52, a homemaker from Danville, Illinois. A Republican, she plans to cast an early ballot for Trump. "I have an elderly father who's 82 that used to go to coffee every morning with his friend, and not being able to do that, it's really taken a toll on him," she said. Public health officials say steps such as social distancing are crucial to containing the virus, especially for seniors who are most vulnerable to the disease. Her husband's business, which provides flood zone certification needed for home sales, has been booming, but they miss the full fellowship of their church. "If you go to church, you wear your mask," she said, "and everybody kind of gets out there quickly." The survey of 1,000 likely voters, taken by landline and cell phone Friday through Tuesday, has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.1 percentage points. When it comes to handling the coronavirus, just 38% approve of the job done by the president, who has been criticized for downplaying the disease and sending mixed messages about how to control it. That's lower than his 48% approval rating in handling the economy and his 44% job approval rating overall. Trump may have paid a price for continuing to hold massive campaign rallies where most of his supporters don't wear face masks and none of them are socially distant from others, as epidemiologists advise. Nearly 6 in 10, 59%, disapprove of Trump's decision to go ahead with his signature rallies despite the pandemic. Trump himself caught the coronavirus, as have more than a dozen members of his inner circle. In contrast, more than 6 in 10, 64%, approve of Biden's decision not to hold large rallies because of COVID-19. Trump has repeatedly mocked Biden for wearing face masks and campaigning, quote, from his basement, end quote, in Wilmington, Delaware. Three people associated with the Biden campaign have tested positive for the virus. Most Americans are braced for trouble when the campaign finally ends. Three of four say they are concerned about the possibility of violence on Election Day and afterward. More than a third are, quote, very concerned, end quote. Only about one in five, 22%, expressed little or no concern. That reflects a significant shift over the past 4 years. In October 2016, the USA Today Suffolk poll found that almost half of Americans, 47%, had little or no concern about violence around the election. Honestly, I'm a little bit frightened, said Valerie Soldatow, 40, of Pittsboro, North Carolina. An independent, she didn't vote in 2016 and has now cast a ballot for Biden, albeit without much enthusiasm, in hopes of bringing about change. There's a lot of division. I feel like there is much more hatred and a lot more aggressiveness being shown by people, and that to me is very frightening, she said. Since the last election, confidence that there will be a peaceful transfer of power has eroded, perhaps because Trump has refused to commit to that. At this point in 2016, 40% of Americans were, quote, very confident, end quote, about a peaceful transfer of power. Now, just 23% are. Nearly 4 in 10 have little confidence that it will happen. On that issue, Republicans are more confident than Democrats. In this election, there is a much deeper fear of violence, not only on Election Day, but for many days thereafter, said David Palaiologos, director of the Suffolk Political Research Center. There is bipartisan agreement, ironically, on whether the country's divisions are deeper than they have been in the past. 69% say they are, a finding that generally holds across party lines. Of 1,000 likely voters polled, only 32 people, or about 3%, say the divisions are less deep than in the past. By 2-1, 58% to 29%, those surveyed say the country has gotten off on the wrong track. Next from the front page, a USA Today investigation. Oversight flaws persist in college accrediting. Agency scrambles after USA Today reporting. By Chris Quintana. The door was locked. The man had knocked, but no one in the South Dakota Business Park answered. The visitor was looking for Reagan National University, accredited as a small, for-profit college operating in Sioux Falls. But he couldn't find anything other than an architecture firm in this mostly empty building, he later said in a memo to colleagues. The man from the Accrediting Council for Independent Colleges and Schools looked up the university and dialed a number on its website. We are not expecting anyone from ACICS, said Adam Yang, listed on the university's website as its dean, who answered the call. Everyone had gotten sick, Yang said, and the university had given them all 2 weeks off, weeks before the coronavirus would sweep the U.S. and interrupt colleges around the country. In fact, a USA Today investigation last winter into Reagan National had found no evidence of students or faculty at the college at all, even though the institution was approved to operate by an accrediting agency sanctioned by U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Colleges that fail to meet accrediting standards should not be approved to operate and receive federal money, and the government counts on accreditors to monitor schools and ensure compliance. But new emails and documents obtained by USA Today show the depth of ACICS's struggle to do so with Reagan National. The stumbles call into question the accreditors' ability to protect students and safeguard taxpayer money, and have prompted federal investigations that could once again bring the DeVos-approved group to the verge of being shut down. Accreditors are supposed to ensure colleges are offering a legitimate education to students that can lead to long-term employment. Colleges they approve can access taxpayer money via student loans and grants. ACICS already had a checkered history, having okayed several high-profile colleges that closed suddenly. The new documents show that despite Reagan National's struggles to meet ACICS's accreditation standards, the governing body did not adequately monitor changes in the college's operations. Its interventions, such as the surprise visit, came after a USA Today reporter inquired with ACICS about broken links on the school's website and an empty campus. All of that, emails show, came as a surprise to the accreditor. ACICS did not respond to multiple requests for comment for this story. A few days before USA Today published its initial investigation, Reagan withdrew from accreditation. No one from the college could be reached for this story. The Education Department later launched an investigation into the accreditor's approval of the university. The department said it was still reviewing documents from ACICS and does not comment on current investigations. Angela Morabito, a department spokeswoman, said the agency had recently introduced new rules meant to protect students from the unforeseen closure of their university. This new rule will safeguard students by paving the way for them to continue learning at another institution with minimal interruption, Morabito said. The House Committee on Education and Labor also started investigating ACICS, obtaining the emails and documents and then releasing them to USA Today. The full outcome of the investigation remains pending. The chair of the House Committee, Bobby Scott, Democrat from Virginia, urged DeVos in a letter in April to rescind the federal government's recognition of the accreditor. The letter also mentioned the accreditor's previous failures. Several of the large for-profit colleges it had accredited, like ITT Tech or Corinthian Colleges, closed unexpectedly in recent years, leaving thousands of students with little to show for years of time and thousands of dollars they'd spent on an education. President Barack Obama's Education Department had stripped the accreditor of its power in 2016. But after a federal court decision reopened the issue, the department, now part of President Donald Trump's administration, reinstated the accrediting agency. ACICS has continued to demonstrate that it is unable to meet basic accreditation standards and that it's incapable of acting to protect students from low-quality predatory institutions, Scott said in the letter dated April 1st. As a result, ACICS's inaction has cost taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars, he said. Over the course of a few days last winter, USA Today reporters discovered major shortcomings at Reagan National University. The college actively was accredited, but website links to student registration or admissions didn't work. Reporters couldn't find any record of the listed faculty members or the president of the university outside of the college's website. And a reporter visited the campus multiple times and found no faculty members or students. Emails show ACICS, charged with monitoring the school, was unaware the college lacked these hallmarks of an operating university. Alerted by USA Today's questions on February 3rd, members of ACICS emailed back and forth about the best course of action given the, quote, urgency of the situation, end quote. One of the staff members, emails show, visited the university's website and noticed the broken links USA Today reporters had found days earlier. That's a big concern, said Michelle Bonacore, director of institutional compliance. ACICS found someone to visit the campus on Saturday, February 8th, although that person is not named. On the accreditor's last visit in December 2019, there were, quote, limited students on campus taking classes in the two classrooms, end quote, staff emails indicated. But the course schedule suggested the weekend might be a good time to visit, quote, to ensure there are students in class, end quote. Visits to troubled college campuses are part of an accreditor's job. The agency's stamp of approval indicates a college is able to offer students a legit education at any given time. Catching shortcomings like a lack of faculty or students should happen in real time. When an accreditor fails to do its job, colleges can mislead students into applying for, enrolling in, and even paying for programs that don't lead to jobs. In some cases, colleges have even pocketed federal financial aid money they shouldn't have been allowed to access. When ACICS finally sent someone to visit Reagan, they found an empty campus. Quote, so there are no students in class today that I may observe and speak to? End quote, the representative asked while on the phone with Yang. That was correct, Yang said. Was there anyone the accreditor could speak to? Everyone is sick, Yang said again. No one will be on campus for 2 weeks. Reagan had struggled to meet ACICS's benchmarks ever since it was first accredited in 2017. Michelle Edwards, the CEO of ACICS, told USA Today in February that the institution initially failed to meet some of the standards for accreditation, but later it did. She declined to elaborate. Then, in January 2019, the university had an issue with its job placement rates. None of its graduates found steady work. The college was given more time by the accreditor to help place its students in jobs. By December 2019, the accreditor dinged the university again for issues related to its grading system, course catalog, and a lack of classroom materials. Without an appropriate response by February 14, the university was warned it could lose its federally approved status. But Reagan continued to operate. USA Today was unable to determine when the college reached its current state, an apparent lack of faculty or students, a broken website, and empty classes. But documents show ACICS didn't notice. When asked in February if ACICS had verified that students were at the college, Edwards said only that the college had been in compliance when it was accredited. Edwards did not respond to questions for this story. After USA Today's inquiries in early February, the accreditor ramped up its oversight. 2 days after the surprise visit, emails show, ACICS sent a letter to Harold Harris, listed on the university's website as its president. The visit showed, quote, there was no evidence of academic activity, ACICS said. For the university to keep its approval status, it would have to provide ACICS a list of its students and faculty and their contact information. It also needed to show students had been given enough notice about the 2-week break and that the university had plans to make up the lost instructional time. Finally, ACICS wanted to know how Reagan officials intended to communicate with students since the website was down. USA Today was unable to determine if the university responded. According to ACICS's website, Reagan withdrew from the accrediting body on February 8th, the same day of the surprise on-site visit. A week later, USA Today published its investigation into the accreditor's oversight of the university. Edwards, the agency's CEO and president, didn't mention the site visit in response to questions for that story. Instead, she said in an email that ACICS took the matter, quote, seriously, end quote, and declined to share details about, quote, the deliberative process of responding to at-risk institutions, end quote. The federal response to ACICS and Reagan initially appeared to be swift. DeVos, in a February congressional hearing, said that she was, quote, not happy, end quote, to read about ACICS's approval of the university. The Department of Education launched an investigation, but few details have been released. The questionable approval of Reagan put ACICS's previous failures on display again. Another controversy, say the accreditation of a university that appeared to lack students or faculty, could be hugely damaging for the agency. An advisory committee that deals with accreditation was scheduled to discuss ACICS in July, but that item was pulled from the agenda. Reagan National University is no longer listed as a tenant at its old address in the Sioux Falls Office Park. The college's website has been scrubbed from the internet, and its previous phone number apparently is disconnected. ACICS, though, continues to approve new institutions. In the past year, it accredited one new university and renewed the standing of several others. It also issued warnings to other colleges for reasons ranging from improperly maintained student records to unclear guidelines for issuing grants. One campus for a time was placed on increased monitoring for operating an unauthorized campus in Iraq. The accreditor is slated to consider approving or renewing the accreditation of 13 universities come December. More institutions mean more money for the struggling organization. As of 2016, the group had 290 members, but now that number stands a little above 60. Critics have said the strained finances of the group could lead it to take on universities that it can't adequately monitor. That could mean more students are at risk of being taken advantage of by predatory colleges. And when a fraudulent institution closes, the government often forgives its students federal loans, costing taxpayers money. What's more, under DeVos, many of the rules around accreditation have been loosened, which could make it harder to track failing programs. If another institution folds, that may mean taxpayers end up footing the bill for the accreditor's failure again. Now we'll turn to the opinions section from today's Des Moines Register. Column from Rekha Basu, Ernst seldom strays from Trump's talking points. After someone has represented you for 6 years in the U.S. Senate, you would expect to have a fairly clear impression of who she is. What inspires, outrages, or calls her to action? What life experiences and philosophies inform her value system? And who is she thinking of when she crafts legislation or casts a vote? Senator Joni Ernst has never really shown us those things. Her maverick status was part of her appeal when she launched her 2014 campaign, a black leather jacket wearing, Harley-Davidson riding Lieutenant Colonel in the Iraq War who spoke with sass about growing up castrating hogs. Whatever you thought of her political stances, her aura of confidence and promises to, quote, make 'em squeal, end quote, in D.C., made you hope she'd be her own person, not beholden or bound by others' expectations. In fact, she has mostly declined to rein in the Republican right wing's top gatekeeper, even when the president has clearly been out of line. Ernst seems too often to want it all ways, to please Donald Trump, to satisfy her donors, and to still pay lip service to groups struggling for an equal foothold in society, like battered women and people of color. Sure, she supported removing the names of Confederate soldiers from military bases. And with some fanfare, she teamed up with Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein to work toward reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, VAWA. She is also one of five Republican senators who recently crossed party lines to vote to move forward a Democratic bill preventing Trump's efforts to overturn the Affordable Care Act in court. But each of those gestures has a qualifier. Ernst voted in the past to repeal the health care law, and each senator who voted to preserve the law is in a tough election bid. It was she who last year blocked Senate consideration of a House bill for reauthorization of VAWA. The National Rifle Association, one of her donors, didn't like the bill because it would have taken firearms out of the hands of boyfriends and ex-spouses convicted of abuse or under restraining orders. As for Black Lives Mattering, despite some supportive-sounding words from Ernst about respecting peaceful protest and needing to learn more about injustices faced by the black community, she has shown a fundamental ignorance about what her black constituents have to deal with. For instance, she criticized her Democratic opponent, Teresa Greenfield, for saying yes when asked by a debate moderator whether systemic racism exists in Iowa. As if to simply say so, even if true, was disrespectful of the state. In June, Ernst introduced the, quote, Ending Taxpayer Funding of Anarchy Act, end quote, saying of West Coast Black Lives Matter protests, quote, What I see is not an effort to talk about racial injustice. I see this as just an expression of hatred towards the United States, end quote. A June 24th report in Iowa Starting Line made reference to a Fox News interview a day earlier and a speech on the Senate floor in which Ernst, quote, seemed to lack basic knowledge of the Black Lives Matter movement in her home state, end quote. Specifically, she was asked what protesters in Des Moines wanted and answered that their main demand was to defund the police. That idea does not appear on, for instance, a top five list the Des Moines Movement's Twitter account posted June 10th. It focused on such matters as banning police chokeholds and expanding voter rights. Another time, Ernst was asked on TV about a Trump tweet accusing a 75-year-old Buffalo, New York protester, pushed to the ground by police, of provoking his own fall. Trump tweeted to suggest the man was an, quote, Antifa provocateur, end quote. Ernst refused to answer or criticize Trump for it, saying only, quote, This is a really tough situation for all Americans, end quote. Eventually, she said, quote, I don't know the facts behind that situation, end quote. Mostly, she moves in lockstep with the president, even on matters where conscience might call on one to oppose him, like on the forcible separation of migrant children from their parents. After some platitudes that children should be well cared for, she declared, quote, This is currently the policy of the administration, and I support it, end quote. And that is usually where Joni Ernst winds up. But don't expect to hear about that in Ernst's campaign ads. Instead, she's got one using the tragic death of a Council Bluffs young woman, killed by a drunk driver without papers, who then fled, to blast immigrants who aren't authorized to be in the United States. Joni Ernst is fighting to keep violent illegal aliens behind bars, says the girl's mother in the TV commercial. So will Ernst also fight to keep citizen drunken drivers who killed someone behind bars? Or at least off the streets? Or just those whose immigration status can be exploited for political gain? Ernst voted with Senator Chuck Grassley against two articles of impeachment against Trump for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Yet she declared that if Joe Biden wins, he could be, quote, immediately, end quote, impeached for, quote, turning a blind eye, end quote, to his son's involvement with the Ukrainian energy company Burisma, because Democrats had, quote, lowered the bar, end quote, for impeachment. She a day later tried to walk some of that back, saying her remarks were taken out of context. She was also forced to apologize for her peculiar defense of Trump's handling of the coronavirus. Ernst tried to pin the jump in numbers on healthcare workers, suggesting they had inflated them for financial gain. But she's sticking with her defense of Trump's refusal to require mask wearing to protect the public against COVID-19. She said, We know that it doesn't work, of the mandates. How do we know that when it hasn't been tried? Fortunately, there's a good alternative. Teresa Greenfield may be a newcomer to politics, but she's smart and committed and is ready to go to bat for real people. Iowans can feel confident of having our interests represented by putting her in office. Now, a guest column from Bill Leonard, retired Des Moines Register editorial writer. Please, let's be done with daylight savings time. We've done it for more than a whole century now, despite the opposition of doctors, traffic safety experts, and a majority of the public. Enough. It's time to quit. Come Sunday, all but a relative handful of Americans will reset their clocks to conform to standard time, marking for the 103rd time the end of daylight saving time. This time for all time, if common sense prevails. Every spring since 1918, Americans have dutifully adjusted their clocks to add an hour of light to evenings and subtract it from mornings. Every fall, we've reversed the procedure. And every switch, a bunch of us do it wrong or forget about it, and we arrive at the party an hour early or an hour late. Massachusetts General Hospital quotes a poll taken last July showing 63% of us favor a year-round standard time, and only 11% prefer changing it every spring and fall. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine thinks we should move to standard time and stay there. Shifting the time messes up your natural rhythms, the Academy says. Standard time's longer morning means you're alert sooner, and earlier darkness in the evening makes falling asleep easier. The issue holds a special meaning for an army of dog owners, of course. Dogs are quick to learn when they can expect their morning rendezvous with nature and are confused when their owners deny it by messing with the clocks. Arizonans have never joined daylight saving time, and Kansans, Oklahomans, and Texans are pushing legislation to dump it. Those states are probably the least likely of any group in the union to be alone together on the correct side of an issue, but hey, there it is. And after all, it isn't forever. If the nation decides daylight savings time doesn't actually pose all the dangers the experts see, and is a good idea after all, we can always restore it a century from now. And here are the letters to the editor. Cartoon misleads about Biden's tax plan. I was very disappointed to see the Register publish the Dana Summers cartoon October 28th displaying a totally untruthful image regarding Biden's tax plan. Unless the middle class just got a large raise to $400,000 a year overnight, you're just allowing negative propaganda to spread in your own pages. I would have replaced the couple with a Wall Street building with the factual statement, quote, "Hand over your corporate tax cuts," end quote. Shameful this got by your fact-check personnel. I expect better. Michael Jensen from Des Moines. Iowans are tough, but can only handle so much. Hospitals can handle COVID-19 cases, says Governor Kim Reynolds. Can they, really? Hospitals are structures. Can the people involved in transporting, diagnosing, caring, cleaning, managing, feeding, and coordinating patient care handle the intense stress placed upon them 24 hours a day? Can the people who are diagnosed handle the terror, the pain, and the isolation? More importantly, can they survive? Can the people left behind, the spouses, parents, and children, handle the stress of dealing with the prospect of death of their loved one, the loss of income, the threat of being infected, the need for childcare, the daily uncertainty of life itself? This is Iowa. We are supposed to take care of each other. We can do much better. Governor, require masks in public places and restrict business hours for places where people gather. People, Iowans come first. Without people, there will be no economy. Do it now before we lose more people. From Joan Lucas in Pella. Liberals overwhelmingly control the bureaucracy and the media. Professor Evan Renfro's assurance that post-election warfare won't happen is based on two requirements he says are necessary: control of both the military and CIA-FBI establishment. Hatch Act data shows these entities and the rest of permanent DC government are utterly in the grip of the progressive left. Hillary Clinton received 95% of 2016 federal employee donations. That includes 99% for the State Department, 97% for the Department of Justice, and 84% from the Department of Defense. Combine those numbers with politics of big media, where only 7% identify as Republican. The result? A toxic brew of violent riots, property destruction, and attacks on the rule of law. Don't blame Donald Trump. He's thoroughly muzzled by big tech and an unabridged negative press. What is not required for violent critical mass is a president supportive of the aggressors. Reagan said it best, quote, "Freedom is only one generation away from extinction," end quote. John Burns of West Des Moines. Turning to the USA Today opinion section, today's topic, 2020 election. Our view. Hail to the determined early voters. Amid a terrifying pandemic, in the face of blatant voter suppression attempts, and with deep concerns about the direction of their country, Americans are going to the polls in record numbers. As of Wednesday, more than 75 million voters had already cast ballots, according to the U.S. Elections Project. This year, for the first time, more people will vote before Election Day than on Election Day. In Washington State, the early vote in this year's general election has been nearly triple what it was at this point in 2016, even though nothing has changed in the way the vote is conducted by mail. In Florida, the early vote has been phenomenal among both Democrats and Republicans, the former voting mostly by mail ballots, the latter more in person. And in Texas, a growing population and a surge in participation rates have produced jaw-dropping numbers. The early vote count, more than 8 million as of Wednesday, was on track to surpass the 2016 total vote of just under 9 million. Some estimates put this year's total vote as high as 12 million. Let us pause for a moment to recognize that all these people voting is an inspiring sign. By turning out in record numbers even before Election Day, they are showing their patriotism and commitment to democracy. Nevertheless, that doesn't mean they should have to wait in line for hours, as many have. In some cases, the lines can be attributed to pure incompetence. In New York, for instance, officials have seemingly learned little from the disastrous primary or the examples of other states. Election organizers could not open enough locations to prevent several-hour lines in many New York City voting places. In other states, the lines are partly a function of efforts to make it hard to vote. In Texas, voters have no choice but to wait in line because the state refused to expand mail balloting beyond seniors and a few others. Texas law forces people to take greater risks to vote than they are comfortable with in other aspects of their lives. In one community in Georgia, voters waited 8 hours to vote earlier this month. 8 hours! The lack of polling places in urban and suburban areas reflects a keen interest by the Republican-controlled state government to suppress the vote in areas with high numbers of Democrats. In the 2018 midterm elections, Georgia was so aggressive at rejecting absentee ballots over signatures that didn't look quite right or other issues that it might well have changed the outcome of a close congressional race. Rejections were high again this year in the state's troubled primary. The Georgia experience underscores that many of the people who are voting in such large numbers are not voting in spite of the obstacles, but because of them. Try to keep people from voting, and people will want to vote. It's just human nature. Beyond surmounting obstacles, many voters are expressing concerns about America's direction and the government's failure to deal effectively with the pandemic. They're responding in the best way possible, with the most important tool at their disposal. Melissa Hanneberger, an editorial writer and columnist for the Kansas City Star, contributed this editorial. West Wing helps me cope with Trump era. Martin Sheen tells me it's stranger than TV fiction. For the past couple of months, I've been escaping from the America in which the president tells white supremacists to, quote, stand by, end quote, and brags about how clean the cages where we keep children are. Late at night, I slip off to the America in which the president can keep a staff and is in constant communication with his conscience. Of course, I'm talking about Jed Bartlett's America in the 1999 to 2006 television show, The West Wing, where the commander-in-chief would rather step down during a personal crisis than risk even the temptation of putting his own interests ahead of ours. Where the leader in the other party who briefly fills in after the 25th Amendment is invoked doesn't try to change the locks at the White House. Where aides, both brilliant and morally sentient, get up every day wondering how they can contribute to the common good. Who knew watching federal employees comply with the Hatch Act could be so stirring? The night Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, it was cathartic to see a grieving President Bartlett ask God what the actual hell in Latin. And during Judge Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings, how poignant to hear potential Bartlett nominees say no president would ever try to replace a conservative Supreme Court icon with a far-left liberal, or vice versa. Lately, on my pretend getaways from the real president, I've been wondering what Josiah Bartlett would make of an election season so late stage in its malignancy, a tape of the First Lady asking, quote, you know, who gives a F about Christmas stuff and decorations, end quote, was barely a one-day story. Actor and activist Martin Sheen, who played President Bartlett, said his character wouldn't see this as a traditional election season. It's a referendum on the Republic, he told me in an interview. That's where we are. Because, and Sheen should know, Donald Trump, quote, is an actor. He's an actor, not a good one, because he has no sense of truth. His instinct is to bully and to be what it's all about all the time. All the time. This administration, what the hell was their policy on anything? I hate to say this, but it is a show. It is a series. Every day is a new episode, and every day it's all about him, end quote. That COVID-19 task force, quote, he never left the stage. He was never more than 3 feet away from whoever was talking and was either approving or disapproving by his body language, end quote. Sheen is blessedly confident that the reality show of Trump's White House will soon be canceled by the American people. And though, yes, a strong liberal himself, he hopes that the GOP, too, can be restored to what it once was. I grew up with Eisenhower. He didn't even know he was a Republican, said Sheen, and might not have become one had the Democrats asked him to run first. He was a general, a servant, a patriot, a fair-minded and decent man, Sheen said. Likewise, Sheen said, the Republicans in the West Wing weren't malevolent. Writer Aaron Sorkin, quote, never trashed the opposition. He exposed them, but he humanized them. Nobody was out to destroy anybody else, end quote. For me, the appeal of Sorkin's fictional public servants is that while they don't always do the right thing, they desperately want to. They know what the right thing is. They are on speaking terms with their better angels, and they don't think scruples are a weakness. It was Sheen's idea to make Bartlett a Catholic and a Notre Dame grad, but the specifics of his faith weren't as important, he said, as that, quote, I wanted Bartlett to face every situation, whether it was personal or public, that he would come from a moral frame of reference. I've always believed that if what you believe is not costly, then you're left to question its value. So I wanted Bartlett to have that as a marker, that whatever he was engaged in, his personal beliefs were going to be costly, end quote. Both when he lived up to them and when he didn't. Does he ever look at this White House and think even a fictional president couldn't have believably gotten away with what Trump has? Yes, Sheen said. Quote, oh my God, can you imagine? End quote. But in the real world, he said, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden really is the antidote. Quote, because he put the focus on character. If you lead an honest life, then it's going to reflect in everything you do, both publicly and privately. If you lead a dishonest life, that too will reflect, and that's what's happening with this administration, end quote. That's where we are, Sheen repeated, but that's not where we're going to stay, end quote. Thank you, Mr. President. By Inauguration Day, I'll have come to the end of my West Wing marathon. But then, if the Trump show is canceled, I won't need it as much. That's it for our second hour of the Register on IRIS. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Susan Hack. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register. The company said Wednesday that it expects to cut its workforce to about 130,000 people by the end of next year, or 30,000 fewer than it began with in 2020. Boeing reported a $449 million loss for the third quarter. Revenue tumbled 29% to $14.14 billion. GE trims losses, expenses, beating Wall Street. General Electric narrowed its losses in its third quarter as it trimmed expenses and managed to post an adjusted profit that surprised Wall Street. GE lost $1.19 billion, or 14 cents per share, for the 3 months ended September 30th. Earnings, adjusted for one-time costs and as-said impairment costs, were 6 cents per share. That beat the expectations of analysts surveyed by Zacks Investment Research.